I'm wondering, like in kindergarten or first grade, do they do like school plays reenacting First Contact Day?
Yes, I think so.
Like Washington crossing the Delaware, that kind of, you know, school play kind of reenactment.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. You've got little paper versions of Cochran's hat.
I was thinking little paper Vulcan ears.
Yeah, little paper. Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Yep. You know, colored mops for green, hair.
I was thinking, like, you know, green tinted face paint for the mm-hmm. Vulcans. You know.
Mm-hmm. Some mops that are dyed black.
Mm-hmm.
Live long and prosper.
Yeah, and you know, and for the grades that aren't doing the play, like the other classes, they get to be in the choir that sings Oogie Boogie.
as long as they throw a little Steppenwolf in there, I'm okay with it.
This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 34 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as he always is Zachary Frühling. Today, we're going to be talking about the issue of nationalism in Star Trek. Zachary, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. You know, Mike, I was watching the news recently, and of course, it's an election year here in the United States with a presidential election right around the corner, and that got me thinking about this question of nationalism or national identity. You know, here in America, we place a lot of value on what it means to be an American and how that plays out in our politics and in elections and whatnot. It just got me thinking, how does the issue of nationalism or national identity play out inside the Star Trek universe? To what extent has the Federation kind of moved beyond this nationalistic impulse that we have, this desire to band together in groups for common interest and form nations and whatnot? And to what extent has the Federation moved beyond that concept toward a more unified or universal approach to politics? And I realized I really didn't have the answer to that. So it struck me as a perfect topic to talk about on Metatrex.
Yeah, I thought this was a fascinating idea myself. Recently in the news, just last month as we're recording this, the historic vote for Great Britain to leave the European Union, as we came to know it, Brexit. And that actually had me thinking at that time about this idea of nationalism and, you know, the effect that decision, that historic vote had on the European Union, had on the world. And what does that look like going forward? So, and what implications does it have for other nations? So that really had me thinking about this topic as well. So I'm really interested to see where we might go with this topic as we talk about it, because in many ways, Zachary, the Federation is sort of a futuristic version of the European Union, or at least the concept of the European Union, where, you know, many of these nation states have come together in order to share and to remove these barriers in trade and things of this nature. And they're working together in union and chorus and common. And now all of a sudden, you know, one of those nation states, in fact, one of their largest nation states, this would be the equivalent of, say, Earth or Vulcan pulling out of the Federation, just suddenly having a vote and exiting from the Federation. That's kind of what we were looking at as we watched those events unfold just a month ago.
Real quick, Mike, before we dive in to talk about nationalism and Star Trek, have you seen the Twitter account Riker Googling?
Yes, I started subscribing to that.
This is one of these things that you know, months from now, no one's going to remember this. But on the day that the Brexit vote occurred, the person running this Riker Googling Twitter feed posted like 50 different things that Riker might Google about the Brexit, as if the Brexit people were an alien race. So, you know, like, how many genders did the Brexit have? You know, do the Brexit have warp technology? You know, things like that. I will forever keep that in mind, you know, when I hear the word Brexit as it relates to Star Trek.
Yeah, I remember seeing some of those as well. It's hilarious to watch that. And it was a little bit of comedy relief there. And what I think was a very tense moment, not only for the European Union, but for the entire world as these events unfolded. It was nice to have a little bit of comedy relief there. But I think about this, Zachary, you know, this concept of Brexit, and if this were happening in the Federation, if Earth or if Tellar or Andoria or Vulcan, any of these kind of founding members of the Federation, if one of them were to suddenly pull out and kind of reassert their, if you will, national identity, although, you know, a united Earth is certainly removed from national identities, but still each of these planets, each of these species, each of these cultures in many ways represent a nation state in the whole of the Federation. And we'll get into a lot of that as we talk.
I was thinking, Mike, have we ever seen an example of a world trying to withdraw from the Federation?
In canon, I don't think so. I know there's a little discussion of it in some of the novelizations, and there's certainly some fanfic out there, but in canon Star Trek, I can't recall an example of a world pulling out or proposing that they pull out of the Federation. However, I think probably one of the strongest examples of certainly courting a nation in and seeing this kind of back and forth, are they in, are they out, are they in, are they out, really we saw kind of unfold in Deep Space Nine with the Federation's courting of Bajor.
Yeah, and the Bajorans keep asserting their own national identity, right? They're concerned about diluting their culture or losing the things that make them uniquely Bajoran, especially just having gone through what's essentially, I don't say a revolution, but they've, you know, won their freedom back from the Cardassians. And now here come the Federation, and they're concerned about their own identity and their culture and whatnot. It's similar to what you see with the Klingons in Star Trek VI, the Klingons being worried about the annihilation of their culture. And so the Bajorans, there are these constant movements to reassert Bajoran nationalism, national identity, in light of this, I don't want to say encroachment, but in light of this movement towards membership in a larger political body.
Yeah, I think that's one of the overall story arcs within Deep Space Nine that I've found really fascinating, really interesting, because, yeah, the Federation has shown up to Deep Space Nine, and in many respects, the Federation, they're in charge. And yet, there on that space station, you have the Bajorans are still wearing their Bajoran uniforms. They still, even down to their comm badges, Zachary, they didn't even take a Federation comm badge. It was a Bajoran comm badge. And there they are, kind of their own identity on this space station, standing apart, standing alone in this really, in many ways, sea of Federation planets and Federation trade and Federation politics and even to some extent a Federation war.
Well, technically, Mike, it's the provisional government that's in charge, but according to Major Kira, that provisional government is a little too provisional.
Indeed, and she's probably one of the strongest proponents of that nationalism for Bajor. In fact, we see her in many episodes in which she's conflicted with the idea of having the Federation there asserting itself, and in many ways she rebels, sometimes subtly, sometimes much more vocally, but in many ways she rebels against this idea of the Federation encroaching on Bajor and its people.
I think that's one of the most fascinating character arcs for Major Kira. You know, she starts out really skeptical of the Federation with a strong nationalist impulse. By the end of Deep Space Nine, she's come full circle, and now she's embraced being part of the Federation. You know, she stands up to Kai Winn about this many different times. She's willing to fight alongside Cardassians for the sake of a larger purpose. And this is a huge character arc for her that's very, very important. But it speaks to the fundamental human slash Bajoran tension about nationalism. On the one hand, people have this instinct to band together for a common purpose. People who are like them, who have similar interests, who have similar needs. This is why we start forming political entities in the first place, I think, right? You know, for mutual protection, for mutual benefit, mutual interests, and whatnot. And that's there's this positive impulse towards nationalism, banding together for the sake of some greater good. The downside of that is that it serves to distance you from people who are different. People have a different national identity and different needs, or a different cultural identity. And it creates this kind of dualism where, you know, we're going to band together over here and we're different from those people who are banding together over there. And it creates all the political tensions that are, you know, basically the history of our own planet. But it's fascinating to me how it boils down to, you know, this basic human temperament, you know, the need to band together and also to distinguish yourself from people who are different from you by embracing ideals that are kind of uniquely your own. You ipso facto kind of push away people who have different ideals, and you say, that's not us. You know, we do this here in the United States. We're Americans. Other people have different identities. Canadians are Canadians, and British are British, and, you know, the French are the French. And South Americans are South Americans. And, you know, whatever the identity is, you know, that's different from being an American. And I'm curious to see how this plays out in the Federation, because the Federation really has its own set of ideals. Federation has its own common interest and its own mutual protection, its own unique culture that's emerged, its own values. And part of being a member of the Federation is to distance yourself from the Klingons and from the Romulans and from the Bajorans and from the Cardassians and anyone who doesn't share those values. And that creates this kind of nationalism at an intergalactic level that's akin to what you see among nation states in the world today.
Yeah, Roddenberry's vision for the Federation was this idea of humanity all grown up, and it's gotten past these, in many respects, immature ideas of nationalism and so on. We're talking about humanity as an adult, you know, out there among the stars, building relationships and sharing and being part of a larger community. And so it really kind of, the idea of the Federation really reminds me of, and we were talking about this in the Turbo Lift, the ideas that John Stuart Mill describes in On Liberty, which he published, I believe, in 1859. And in On Liberty, he describes society as this kind of advancement of liberalism to the point that, you know, while we had the ability to amass wealth and progress ourselves, we really don't see the need for those things. We don't see the need for nationalism. We don't see the need for all of these other ideas that it leads to. He says human nature is not a machine to be built after a model or to be set to do exactly the work prescribed for it, but it's a tree which requires only to grow and develop itself on all sides according to the tendency, the inward forces which make it a living thing. And so this idea that humanity is going to grow and develop into something very natural, and we're not going to put it inside this set of rules where we have these borders and you know, this little group's working toward their common good and you do your thing over there. No, we're sharing. We're, it's liberalism really at its full maturity.
I like to think of this issue of nationalism as a type of development process. You know, you could argue that the world today, with its nation states that war with each other, even though we're probably more unified than we were, you know, 100 years ago, for sure. Mm-hmm. So there's been even progress in our own world today with United Nations and whatnot. But, you know, we're still kind of in an infancy. We have nations that war with each other or partner with each other to various degrees, and that shapes the history of our world. In the world of the 23rd and 24th centuries, our world has moved beyond that. You know, the idea of a nation on Earth, as you know, multiple nations on Earth, has become antiquated. That's something that in the past, you know, the America as a separate country, the United States of America as a separate country, is no more. Same thing with France, much to Picard's chagrin, right? According to Picard, the proper colors of the flag are what now? They're not red, white, and blue. They're what order is the French flag in?
Well, that actually comes from The Last Outpost, where they were talking about the Ferengi as Yankee traitors and made a reference to them being dressed as Uncle Sam in red, white, and blue. And Tasha Yar, of course, is, you know, she's clueless. Well, what, you know, what do bright primary colors have to do with it? And Picard says, I understand the illusion. Colors representing countries at the time when they competed with each other, red, white, and blue for the United States, whereas the French more properly used the same colors in the order blue, white, and red.
Exactly. So even Picard hasn't quite, you know, divorced himself from this French nationalism that he grew up with.
No, he's a proud Frenchman with a British accent.
But basically in the 23rd and 24th centuries, we move beyond the concept of nations on a particular planet, right? The nations of Earth have banded together and formed, you know, Earth is a single unified entity in the 23rd, 24th century. Now, as we in Star Trek, in universe, as we become an intergalactic species, as we form political partnerships with other nations, other planets, as other planets join the Federation, there's this nationalism at kind of an intergalactic level, right? I mean, the Federation is still a state. It's got a flag. It's got its own values. It's got a constitution. All the things that define a country here on Earth today, or a nation on Earth today, the Federation has in the 23rd mm-hmm. and 24th century. And other political entities, basically at the planet level, we're talking the Cardassians or the Klingons or the Romulans. They have their own flag. They have their own symbols. They have their own values. They've got their own political rules. And so the situation as I see it in the 23rd and 24th century is analogous to what you see on Earth today. You know, the Federation is in a position of having to interact with these other cultures and other worlds and other political entities. And so people who are in the Federation feel some pride, feel some affinity to the concept of being a Federation member. We see that throughout the Star Trek universe. People are proud to be in Starfleet. They're proud to be a member of the Federation. They agree with the values that the Federation holds. And, you know, kind of as I see it, you know, I guess the fundamental question I have is to what extent the Federation wants to move beyond that. Is it still the Federation's goal to try to transcend this idea of nationalism at an intergalactic level by continuing to have other worlds join the Federation and have a unification of values and a unification of political structures? And what comes to mind is the speech Picard gives in Star Trek Nemesis inside the Romulan Senate chamber, when he essentially says, you know, the Federation is committed to this idea that all nations can come together in peace and live in harmony. You know, there's this kind of trend towards political unification that I see in the Federation as more and more worlds join the Federation. Or is the Federation content to have its own national identity and live alongside a bunch of other political entities that aren't willing to join the Federation for one reason or another? So what is the Federation's own ideal about what the purpose of a political organization is?
Yeah. When you talk about the Federation, back to my original point about the European Union, I mean, the European Union is the embodiment of John Stuart Mill's idea of liberalism. I mean, the trade barriers have come down. You know, those kind of barriers among member nations have disappeared. People are free to move anywhere within the European Union in order to pursue their education, opportunities to better themselves, to work. People could go to the best schools. It didn't matter if that school was in Germany and you lived in France. You could go to the best schools. And by pursuing your own goals, the idea was that society as a whole is improved. And so that certainly sounds like the Federation. And so when I think about the Federation, I think about this concept where, you know, you have that kind of agreement going on between these planets. And let's backtrack a little bit, Zachary. In order to get to the Federation, I mean, we have to have the understanding that here on planet Earth, those nation states have all dissolved and the world has come together under the banner of a single united Earth government.
coming out of World War III in universe.
Exactly.
Right?
Coming out of World War III in universe. And so they've come together. They've over the course of 100 years after, you know, Cochrane's Phoenix flight, they have defeated poverty. They've defeated hunger. And so now we're beginning to take our first steps into the galactic community, a community that many of the nations that we build trust and relationships with will come together to form the Federation. And assuming that all of those worlds themselves have gone through a similar genesis or transformation or evolution, take your pick of terms, where they've done away with the divisions in their own planetary body, and they've come together and united, and now they too are joining this greater community. But really, at the end of the day, what you have are little nation states out there in the universe. So here for humanity, is there a sort of a national pride, if you will, for humanity, as opposed to, you know, those Tellarites and their pig noses? And by the way, we should probably talk about this a little bit. Nationalism sometimes connotes a negative connotation when you talk about it, because we understand that sometimes nationalism does lead to negative behaviors such as racism and things of this nature. So you kind of have to separate and define terms. But, you know, if we have this national pride of humans as opposed to the Tellarites or the Andorians, or I would imagine that does exist in the Federation. In fact, there's one of my favorite episodes, honestly, of Deep Space Nine, really is about that very thing, and that's Take Me Out to the Holosuite, where it was the Vulcan pride, if you will, that really got Sisko's goat to the point that, you know, he's throwing down the gauntlet. They're going to meet for a game of baseball in the Holosuite.
I'm glad you thought to mention the different varieties of nationalism, because up till now we've kind of been talking about nationalism as if it's only one thing, just one thing called nationalism. But in reality, there are a great many factors that can lead to a nationalist instinct. And, you know, there's more than one kind of nationalism as a result. And so as we talk about nationalism, I think it's important to kind of break this down into the different factors that can result in people banding together to form a nation, and also to talk about the pros and cons of it. I think, you know, largely to our 21st century ears, especially in Star Trek terms, where the idea is that we've transcended this idea of nationalism, the term nationalism to us has a largely negative connotation. But there are a great many positive elements to it. I mean, part of nationalism is this idea of patriotism, coming together with people who have a shared identity for a common purpose. Mm-hmm. And a lot of good has been done in our own world as a result of those concepts. A lot of evil has been done in the world as a result of those concepts. Sure. But what we don't want to do is be overly simplistic and say that nationalism in general is bad and it's something to transcend in the 23rd and 24th centuries, because even in the 23rd and 24th centuries that we admire in the Star Trek universe, there are these nationalistic elements that we've identified a little bit, you know, things like shared identity, things like having a political structure, things like having values, things like you know, being proud to be a member of your society. Those are all good things that we see in the 23rd and 24th century. So it's important to distinguish the different factors that can lead to that, to people forming a political unit, and then really, you know, step back and say, okay, what good comes of that and what bad comes of that. In the best case scenario, you get what we see in any of the healthy countries in the world today. You know, we get pride in being part of your country. Mm-hmm. You get values that people agree with that are generally positive. You get rights and values that are important for having a well-functioning world. And then, you know, if you all the good that comes of those things, right? There's lots of good things you could point to. And then in the worst case scenario, that nationalism devolves into things that have these very negative connotations. It could devolve into Nazism, or it could devolve into racism, or it could devolve into terrorism, the kinds of things you see with ISIS mm-hmm. these days. this nationalistic instinct that says, you know, we're the only right way to do things, and we're going to go out and, you know, harm everyone else who's different. That's nationalism in its worst. But things like patriotism, things like having an organized society share around common values, those create order in the world. That's an important part of any healthy society. And I would say that there's a patriotic slash nationalistic element that has played a good positive role in the development of the healthy organized world that we have today. You know, what you don't want is an apolitical society where you have sheer anarchy, right? You know, so if that's one extreme to be avoided, the anarchy extreme, and the other extreme would be the nationalism run rampant, you know, Nazism or terrorism mm-hmm. or racism and whatnot, then the reality is probably somewhere in the middle. People still need to band together for a shared purpose, but you can't band together so much, to the exclusion of causing harm to other people who aren't part of your group. Sure. And where that line is between, anarchy and, healthy, patriotic nationalism and extreme, nationalism a la Nazis or nationalism a la terrorists, right? That is, where that line is a little blurry, because I think, we like the good parts of nationalism and we want to transcend the bad parts. It's just not obvious that you can separate the good from the bad there.
Indeed. I'm glad you mentioned the extremes, anarchy, and then, devolving the other way and having something, more like tribalism or racism, something like that. I think it's important that many fans in many aspects think of the Federation as something that has moved beyond nationalism, but indeed we've mentioned several cases already in just these first minutes of the podcast today in which nationalism is alive and well in the 23rd and 24th century in the Star Trek universe. And so, I think it's difficult for those concepts to just disappear. I mean, my goodness, this idea of communal identity is very much ingrained in the human species, going all the way back to when human beings lived together in tribal communities. They were clans, they were family groups, people groups, in which they existed together and they worked together for, toward common goals. They were there to protect one another against, aggressors from the outside. And so they lived together in tribes and clans. And then that over the generations, as, we've taken down, the barriers of transportation and things of this nature, we've just kind of expanded to the point that we no longer live in genetic tribes where we're all kind of related to one another, but rather, we're all working together towards common principles, common good, and, give ourselves in many respects to a common ideal, and that's how we exist together in the United States, where you and I live. Even though you live in California and I live in Texas, we are still part of this community called the United States. And so, statehood has diminished itself to the idea of a national identity. And I imagine one of these days that national identity will give way to a more of a global identity. And then who knows, maybe somebody manages to break the warp barrier and we find ourselves introduced to another species of humanoid beings or non-humanoid beings out there in the greater galaxy, and we become part of the universal community like is depicted in the Star Trek universe.
I love the narrative you just gave, Mike, because it reminds me very much of the kinds of fictional narratives that you get inside the writings of most modern political philosophers. Modern in the sense of modernity, like the 16th and 17th and 18th mm-hmm. centuries, as opposed to contemporary. In almost all of those political writings, from John Locke to Thomas Hobbes, you get, their great political works start with an origin story. Here's the history of mankind in its natural state and how that has led to the formation of political societies. Thomas Hobbes gave his account of the state of nature being nasty, brutish, and short, and people banding together for mutual protection out of fear, and that leads to social contracts that lead to societies. John Locke gave a very different account of the state of nature, where man is has innate rights and the right to life and liberty and property for John Locke, and his account of the state of nature led to a very different kind of political society in his writings. And you just gave a very interesting kind of narrative of the history of mankind, banding together for mutual protection. It's very much like Thomas Hobbes, I think, banding together for mutual protection, protecting yourselves from forces outside. But what happens in that situation, as you described it, in my mind, is that there's a need to kind of distinguish yourself from the other, right? The people who've banded together now need something to rally around. Mm-hmm. And so whenever a society like this, again, this is a little fictional because we don't really know how societies were formed, right? We can kind of extrapolate, these sort of primitive societies and how those led to modern societies. Sure. But I think largely this is speculation. We're coming up with our own false narrative here to justify, whatever we're about to say. But there's a need to kind of distinguish yourself. My society wears this color and your society wears that color. And my society has these kinds of beads and your society has those kinds of beads. And we wear furs while you wear woven cloth or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And so the formation of societies, in my mind, I find this very interesting, is intertwined with this symbolic representation of whatever society you're a part of. This is why we have flags, and this is why we have historical events that we point to, and this is why we have colors, and these things serve to band people together around a shared identity. The reverence that you and I feel towards looking at an American flag is something that most Americans feel in one way or another, and that unifies us together in a society. So there's a powerful symbolic element to this, and so I think it's no accident that in the Federation you still have a flag, because that serves to unify a bunch of people around a symbol that represents an idea of what the Federation can be. And other societies in the 23rd and 24th century have their flags and their symbols and their graphics and their type of uniforms and these kinds of distinguishing artificial or symbolic representations of what their society are supposed to stand for. And I think if you go sort of world by world through the Federation, you can go, oh, you can see a flag or a different kind of uniform or a different kind of architecture or a different kind of whatever. And those serve to distinguish one group from another. And so I guess the question is, what is that, a good thing or a bad thing in the 23rd and 24th century? Is that the kind of thing that is useful for unifying people together around the ideals of the Federation that all of us Star Trek fans, I think, relate to in one way or another? The ideals of tolerance, the ideal of unification, the ideals of moving beyond our differences and coming together for a shared purpose. These are all ideals that we have as Star Trek fans, I think. To one degree or another. I think it means probably different things to different ones of us. But is that the ideal? The ideal is to kind of transcend these nationalistic factors, or are those useful tools for rallying people around an ideal that we all happen to agree with, having this thing that we love together as Star Trek, or if for any particular country, those symbols serve this unifying factor. I think here in America we have our unifying symbols. Other countries have their own unification symbols. I'm thinking, our neighbors to the north, the Canadians, they have the maple leaf flag, and Canadians feel something about that binds them together. And I think that's a good thing, because it reminds people, those symbols are powerful. They remind people of their ideals. And so I really want to kind of draw out the positive elements of this nationalistic instinct, because I think it would be overly simplistic to just say that in the 23rd and 24th century, we've progressed to the point where we don't need those things anymore. I think it's implausible, first of all, and I think it contradicts what we actually do see in the Star Trek universe with the rich symbology that's part of the universe that we like.
I agree. It is implausible. And for that matter, I'll even go beyond that to say that I think it's counterintuitive to what we as human beings I think are even capable of. I don't want to put humanity in a box and say that we can't transcend nationalism, but I do want to kind of go back to my original statement and say this is something that is very much ingrained in who we are as human beings. I would be remiss, Zachary, if I didn't kind of fall back a little bit on my theological and religious history training and kind of draw a little bit out of that and say that, for instance, the Jewish people who we have a very detailed record of their history. And that history tells us about a very nomadic people that came together in first of all, in family groups, in tribes. There were 12 of them. They were the 12 sons of a man who became known as Israel. And these 12 sons were each the head of their own tribe. And as the generations passed, those tribes, some of them got very large and some of them were small. And they still lived in their small tribes, but when the time came and they needed to band together in order to support one another, they were able to do that. Some of the smaller tribes were a little less able to defend themselves against aggressors. There were things like famines and droughts in which they had to kind of pull together as an overall community and support and help one another weather those challenges. And then eventually they became unified under a king. And that's kind of an overly simplistic way of putting it, as was my narrative before, but that's kind of it in a nutshell. So this is very ingrained in who we are as a people, this idea of coming together and finding commonality and transcending self in order to become a part of something larger. And we really see that in terms of the Federation. And I don't think it's a bad thing, because after all, if you look at, for instance, let's go to Enterprise. Humanity's kind of out there on their own in Enterprise, and yet they find themselves up against challenges, and it's not always another species or someone with more firepower. Sometimes it's just the circumstances that they found themselves in, and they need the help and support of other species, the Andorians, the Vulcans. You know, there's nothing like watching Jonathan Archer eat a little humble pie and ask a Vulcan for help. And so we kind of see this idea of the Federation taking form. It's not a bad thing. It's a great thing. It's a good thing. It enabled for the sharing of technology and the advancement of not just one, but the whole. And that idea, that concept doesn't go away as we move into the era of the Federation with the original series and with the Next Generation, Voyager, Deep Space Nine. That idea, that concept just expands, it enlarges as we bring other worlds into this thing of the Federation. And there is a certain pride. There are things I think that they would sort of rally around. I don't know if they have a Federation Founders Day or anything like that, but who knows? Maybe they do. And those are moments of great, if you will, national pride for those members of the Federation. But the Federation as a whole has also found a way to live in, I won't go as far as to say harmony, but, you know, to have a good relationship with other worlds that don't wish to be a part of the Federation. I think probably one of the best examples of that would be the Klingons. You know, we see the Klingons going through a difficult time. And I remember at the end of Star Trek VI thinking, you know, the Klingons are going to be part of the Federation, but, you know, that just wasn't to be. They maintain and manage to maintain their own identity without really becoming a part of the Federation.
I have a hard time seeing how the Klingons will move beyond being an empire, right? I can't picture the Klingons actually joining the Federation. I could see, you know, certainly the Klingons have, you know, diplomatic relations with the Federation. You know, they can be allies with the Federation, but I can't see the Federation or the Klingons giving up their empire for the sake of joining the Federation. Do you see that being a real possibility?
It's difficult for me to see that, although I don't think it's impossible, because I think that's one of the interesting conflicts that Worf has as a character. I mean, my goodness, here is a Klingon, a son of the Empire, wearing a Patox uniform on the bridge of a Federation vessel. And really, Worf represents more of a a civic nationalism, probably more than anything, where he was raised by humans and he's been convinced that these ideals are noble and that they are worth fighting for, living for, and certainly for dying for. But that causes a lot of conflict as he interacts with other Klingons who just cannot understand how this son of the Empire could wear that uniform and serve on that ship.
And of course, we've observed many times before that Worf is simultaneously like a defective Klingon. He doesn't embody what other Klingons actually do. And at the same time, he represents the best of Klingon ideals in various ways. So Worf is an interesting paradox. But a minute ago, Mike, I'm glad you thought to mention the history of a people like the Jewish people, because it speaks to the different factors that can be relevant for people's tendency to form their own identities, form their own national identities mm-hmm. and groups and whatnot. And I think there's a great many different factors. And I put together just a small list of different types of nationalism or different types of factors that can cause people to band together. And it's interesting because each one of them has a potential positive element and a potential negative element when you take it to an extreme or when you take it to out of proportion in some way. You mentioned one of them already, civic nationalism, just the most straightforward idea that you come together for the sake of mutual protection and mutual benefit and whatnot. And that sounds like it's a great idea. I think that's sort of one of the fundamental ideas behind nationalism, that we form groups for the sake of mutual protection, mutual benefit. But when you take that to its extreme, when you start to over-organize society to the point where you're infringing on people's individual freedoms, for example, that can become civic nationalism taken too far, mm-hmm. right? And you can go down the list. Okay, what's another type of nationalism? Okay, ethnic nationalism. You mentioned that already with the Jewish people, and I think throughout Star Trek, you see this in Star sure. Trek, right? The Klingons have an ethnic identity, and the Romulans have an ethnic identity, and so on and so forth. Ferengi have an ethnic identity. And, that's great because it can, again, bind people together around a certain shared history, a certain evolutionary history, a cultural history. And then when you take that too far, when ethnic nationalism becomes something like ethnic cleansing or racism and whatnot, that's ethnic nationalism taken to too much of an extreme. So I think, there's nothing in my mind inherently negative about people of a shared history coming together for a particular purpose. But when that's done out of, to the exclusion of other people, or when that's done, causing harm to other people. And in fact, there's something in my mind, even a little aesthetically beautiful about this idea that there's a diversity of different kinds of people who all band together and have their own culture and their own values. I think the sort of pluralism of that has an aesthetic beauty that you see in the Star Trek universe, and the Federation embraces that. I think when it encounters a new culture, it treats it reverently because it's inherently beautiful. It doesn't want to go in and destroy it. It doesn't want to immediately make them part of the Federation and destroy those cultural elements. I think that shared ethnic / cultural history is an important part of the aesthetic, the beauty of the aesthetics that you see in the Star Trek universe.
Yeah, I have to mention this, Zachary. We do this as Star Trek fans. One of the things that I love about being a Star Trek fan is, for instance, I was out the other day. I was wearing my Trek FM shirt. I was wearing some merch, which, by the way, listeners,
Trek FM Nation, is that
Trek
what you're
FM
saying?
Trek FM Nation. By the okay. way, listeners, you can go to our Redbubble store, and we have a bunch of merch in there, some incredible designs by our art director, Aaron Harvey. You can get a Trek FM shirt. There's the Trek FM word bubble that has all of the names of our different podcasts and some of our greater catchphrases, all kind of shaped like the Enterprise. You can get that on phone covers and pillows, shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies, you name it. It's available out there. Check out Trek FM's Redbubble store. You can go to trek.fm/store. There I was, Zachary, wearing my Trek FM shirt. I walked into a store. This guy just comes out of nowhere and he goes, "Hey, you're a Star Trek fan." It's like, yeah. And he puts up the "Live Long and Prosper," and he's giving me the Vulcan salute. And all of a sudden there was this there was this camaraderie between us. I didn't know him at all. He's just another face in a large store here in this huge, vast, diverse Dallas, Texas area. But yet we were able to connect on that very basic level of the fact that both of us were Star Trek fans.
Are you saying, Mike, that we here who are part of the Trek FM family have ornamented ourselves with t-shirts and logos and whatnot for the sake of mutual protection against other podcast networks?
Well, I mean, we have to represent, Zachary. I don't want to say anything negative. I don't want to give our listeners the idea that those other podcasts encroach against us, which they do. No, they don't. All kidding aside, we just have to represent people. We listeners, we just have to represent. So, Redbubble store, get your merch and represent. But it's interesting though that we can connect with total strangers based on the fact that we're all fans and we have that in common.
See, now I kind of want to know what 24th century swag is. You know, like we've got our Trek FM swag. You know, what kinds of things do people in the 23rd and 24th century ornament themselves with to distinguish themselves as part of the Federation? Like in Starfleet, you definitely have Starfleet uniforms and the Delta Shield and whatnot. But is there 24th century swag in one variety or another? I'm not sure we've seen that very much.
All I know is I'd like to see Jonathan Frakes tweet a picture of himself in a Trek FM shirt. I'd buy the shirt.
See, like the Bajorans have their swag, right? They've got the earpieces and whatnot. And I can envision like black market earpieces, like a Bajoran competition, who can wear the coolest earpiece. I see that in some races in Star Trek, but in the Federation, have they moved beyond the need for swag to identify themselves as part of a unique group? And there's something fundamentally human about that. We do tend to ornament ourselves to distinguish ourselves as a unique group in one way or another. And is that something that's just passé in the 24th century?
Well, it's funny that you should mention the Bajorans and their earrings, because again, that is an example of how we see where if you're in a crowd of people, besides the obvious, the 5 to 7 ridges on their nose, you can be in a crowd of various species and that earring immediately sets you apart as a Bajoran. And so those two Bajorans, they have that in common. And so it breaks down some barriers, maybe advances the comfort for one party, both parties. So they're able to rally around. You mentioned swag. I don't know. You know, do they have Born in the Federation shirts, some kind of, I'm thinking some kind of 24th century version. I'm picturing Riker doing his straddle, you know, where he puts his leg up on the console and he's wearing a pair of jeans and he's got a shirt on that says Born in the Federation.
See, Riker's proud of the fact that he's born in Alaska, right? But do you get like t-shirts that say like born in Sector 001 or anything like that?
I could see the Borg doing something like that. You know, that just to express themselves, you know, to kind of set themselves apart in the collective, you know, species 35412.
See, and is there like a counterculture, like, you know, like here in America, sometimes we get people driving around with the Confederate flag that's supposed to represent something. And you know, do you get the equivalent of that in the 24th century? Is there an equivalent of people driving around a big shuttlecraft in outer space with the equivalent of the Confederate flag flying behind it? You know, maybe like an American flag because it's so passe and, you know, we've moved beyond America. So are there a group of throwbacks that, you know, fly the American flag behind their shuttlecraft?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. Of course, I live here in Texas, so it's not an uncommon thing to be driving around and see a truck flying, you know, an American flag on one side and a Texas flag on the other. I saw one the other day where they had an American flag, a Texas flag. They had four, five, six flags flying off the back of this thing. So absolutely, why wouldn't we have a shuttlecraft out there with, you know, a one world Earth flag and a Federation flag, and we've got to get all the member species in there. So we got a Vulcan flag and a throwback Tellarite flag, and why not? I say let's go for it.
Yeah, I really want to see more of this. Like, I want to know what kinds of rituals revolve around these different national emblems that you see inside Star Trek. Like, you know, like when Federation children are growing up, do they have to say "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United Federation of Planets"? That kind of thing. Do they stand up and salute the flag? You know, how are these? You know, certainly the symbol's there, right? I mean, the flag is draped over a coffin. You know, if a Starfleet member dies, so it's not, mm-hmm. even the starships have Federation symbols on them, like the Starfleet Delta shield is on, sure, on the side of the original Enterprise. So, the world of the 23rd and 24th century is not symbolist. So I just want to understand better what role those symbols function, what role they play in contemporary Federation society in the 23rd and 24th centuries. Do they have this nationalist role, or are they purely decorative? I mean, are we giving them way too much importance and way too much weight? Do they not play that role for people in the future, or will they play a role similar to what role our national symbols play for us today?
Yeah, and they don't really talk about it a lot in the Star Trek universe, but I know many of our fans are aware that in the original concept of what we come to know as the original series in Star Trek, each ship had its own insignia. And so the Delta Shield was the insignia of the Enterprise. But interestingly enough, as Star Trek evolved, it really became the symbol of Starfleet as a whole, and very, very much a part of the identity of the Federation. So it's kind of interesting how that evolved. And in universe, I don't know. I mean, certainly they've integrated this into a comm badge. So For instance, at my job, I have to wear a name badge that has our company's logo on it, and that's kind of part of my uniform, as it were. So that identifies me as being an employee of the company, and it identifies me with the company. So in many ways, that comm badge really kind of is that sort of swag, if you will, that they wear, and it identifies them. No matter where they go, they're easily identifiable as a member of the Federation.
And we're recording this in July of 2016, which happens to be an Olympic year. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what the Olympics of the 23rd and 24th centuries would be like, different member nations of the Federation, or even outside the Federation, might come together for the Olympic Games. Would they have to add a few more colored rings to the Olympic logo to account for different color flags and different races out there? Would they get a purple flag in there for the Cardassian, or purple ring in there and whatnot? I'm just curious what... how those kinds of institutions that we have here that are supposed to be transnational, right? Whereas the whole idea behind, something like the Olympic Games was to say, let's set aside our national identities and come together for the sake of doing an activity that celebrates, achievement, but not focusing on national identity for its own sake, but yet retaining that sense of cultural identity in the pride in winning a gold medal for your country. it's a really interesting duality of transcending the conflict of nationalism while maintaining your national identity and representing your country at this transnational event or organization called the Olympics. And how things like that would play out in the 24th century are fun to think about for me.
Well, you brought up sports. Let's talk a little bit more about, I mentioned it earlier, Take Me Out to the Hollow Suite. The premise of that particular story is Sisko has a rivalry going back to his academy days with a very pompous Vulcan. And he's shown up on Deep Space Nine. His ship needs some maintenance. His crew needs some R&R. So there they are. And Sisko immediately feels that same animosity that he felt back in his academy days. And it is compounded by the fact that this particular Vulcan hasn't changed a bit. He's still the pompous, arrogant Vulcan that he was then. And so his whole air is that Vulcans as a species are in every way superior to every other species within the Federation. In fact, and I don't know how it's even possible in the 24th century, but this Vulcan has, an all-Vulcan crew. And he believes that it's the best crew in the fleet, and there are just no others that can compare. And so that arrogance manages to get Sisko to agree to a contest. And so they meet for a game of baseball in the Hollow Suite. It is the Niners versus the Logicians.
Well, Mike, that all Vulcan crew in that episode of Deep Space Nine might think that they're the best baseball team in Starfleet. But did you know that Commander Riker was actually the Parisi Squares gold medalist in the 2368 Olympics? So, Captain Solok can suck it.
Yes, Solok, there.
Take that, Captain Solok.
Take that, Captain Solok.
So I refuse to believe that this nationalistic element has been totally weeded out in the 24th century. I think the way in which you see Captain Sisko's crew, the crew of Deep Space Nine, band together for the sake of winning this baseball team against the Vulcan team, that is such a basic part of any group organization, the need to distinguish yourself and the need to one-up other people. I can't even see breeding that out of mankind. I don't even think it's a good thing to breed that out. I think that healthy competition can move people forward in a great many ways. And the history of our own world is one based out of competition. And what is competition if not saying me versus you, my group versus your group, let's go head to head and see who can do the best job. And if you can take the violence out of that and you can turn it into healthy, productive competition, then you can really move culture and move the world forward in a great many interesting, positive, productive ways. It's when it devolves into war and violence and prejudice and hatred that all the problems that we see in our own world come to fruition. But I don't see anything wrong with a little healthy competition and a little healthy group identity for the sake of upping your game a little bit.
Absolutely. And, you know, somebody needed to explain it to Worf. One of my favorite scenes in this episode is Sisko says, "All right, Niners, let's hear some chatter out there. Hey, bada, bada, bada. Hey, bada, bada." Worf, death to the opposition. it's great. Somebody needed to explain that concept to Worf, because he certainly took it a little too far. But I love this episode, and it does demonstrate that nationalism, to some degree at least, is alive and well in the 24th century. And as you said, Zachary, it's not necessarily a bad thing, because really, in many ways, the crew of Deep Space Nine came together for this competition. And the scene at the end of that episode is just fantastic. They lost the game, but they came together and they broke down barriers. It's funny because Max Grudzinchik is depicted in this, his character Rom is depicted in this as the worst baseball player on the team. Sisko throws him off, and it becomes a kind of a point of contention, if you will, for the team. At the end of the episode, he brings him back in and lets him play, and he, you know, bunts, and they have, you know, their great moment. But in truth, Max Grudzinchik was the best ball player among the cast and crew there. In fact, I remember reading that he had to bat left-handed in order to even appear as though he were somewhat clumsy, and still had to act it up a little bit.
And I love the way that last scene is played with the Vulcans, because the Vulcans point out how illogical the response is to be gloating when they've basically lost. And, you know, out here in California, you know, we in the Bay Area tend to be either Giants fans or A's fans when it comes to baseball. And I happen to be a Giants fan. Go Giants. But, you know, there's an interesting phenomenon that you can observe after sporting events, that for the team that loses, they can often be just as proud, if not more proud, of their team in this totally illogical kind of way, sticking to their team even in the losses, even being proud of the fact, you know, trying to agitate the people on the other side, all of which flies in the face of logic. And I love that it takes the Vulcans to point out the illogic of this. And the humans just don't care. They're going to be illogical. They're going to stick to their team, stick to their group. They're going to keep trying to poke holes in the Vulcans and, you know, and stir the pot. And that's human nature. We tend to stick to our groups almost regardless of what counter evidence there is. You know, we'll stick to our culture, stick with our people we know. And that, there's a bad part of that, because it can be a force that works against coming together as a larger group, right? The good side of that is, you know, people tend to stick together. It's like being down in the trenches together in some way. You know, people who are bonded together over these factors will stay bonded together come hell or high water, no matter what happens, whether their team loses, whether their country is having a depression. You know, the ability to band together in when it's totally illogical to do so, in the face of all the counter evidence, in the face of all the difficulties, is an important part of, I would say, human tenacity, right? You don't want to breed that out, because that's what allows us to get through the hard times together as a group. And how that plays out in a political organization in the future, I have no idea, because it strikes me that you still want people to come together for mutual good, and especially stay together when the times get tough. And that can be kind of illogical. You know, sometimes, you know, the forces can say, look, you know, it's why don't you disband and go do something else? Why don't we take the Federation apart? Why don't we let you know, one of the member worlds of the Federation disassociate itself mm-hmm. from the Federation when times get tough. Because that's not what we do. We band together for the sake of mutual good, even when times get tough. And that sounds illogical when times get tough, I think. So I think it's an important part of continuing to band together and continue to do good for the mutual benefit of society. I wouldn't want to see that bred out of people in the 24th century. I really wouldn't.
I think it's a shame sometimes that it takes a tragedy in order to bring the very best out of people. For instance, you know, we think about all the differences that exist here in the United States and certainly around the world. And yet when there's a national tragedy, it just never ceases to amaze me how, regardless of our differences, we can all come together for mutual support and help. And I can think of example after example after of example where, you know, groups just came together and they set aside differences and, you know, they helped and supported one another through, you know, terrible tragedies, terrible times. And I think it's a shame that it takes those types of tragedies. There's a criticism out there, Zachary, if I can switch gears just a little bit. And certainly I agree with you on all points about Take Me Out to the Holosuite and all of the wonderful things I think it represents. And it really shows this concept of nationalism, really, I think, at its best. But there's a criticism out there, certainly among fans, that in many ways the Federation represents this idea of colonialism, in which they take their nationalism and they encroach and impose it on other groups that maybe don't want anything to do with the Federation. That certainly existed in a great degree with the Bajorans when the Federation showed up on Deep Space Nine. They were by and large unwelcome. They just weren't wanted. They're sticking their noses into their business, and you're here just to suck us into the Federation. And certainly once we get to Star Trek Insurrection, we kind of see the Federation on steroids as it's just fast-tracking all of these worlds in with, you know, almost zero accountability, if you will, from that world to conform in any way. There's the criticism exists the United States has been very much that way, in which multiculturalism has eroded, if you will, the identity of our country to the point that we just, you know, aren't the nation that we were a generation ago. And so those criticisms exist, and I think it's important to mention those both in the dialogue of nationalism and certainly as it relates to Star Trek.
I think the issue of colonialism is interesting because there's nationalistic elements on both sides of whatever interaction is going on there.
Precisely.
The organization that is being colonialist, you know, going out and encroaching on other cultures or other societies or other territories, there can be a nationalistic force that is driving that colonialism, that, you know, trying to expand your own territory or expand your own empire, right? And people can rally around this idea of being a colonial empire. I think that this happened in the British Empire, mm-hmm. right? And you can see that in any empire in Star Trek. The Romulan Empire does this. The Klingon Empire does that. Any empire that is trying to expand its territory will fall in that category, I think. And almost without fail, there's a nationalistic identity associated with that. On the other hand, if you're being encroached on, that can reinforce your own national identity in reaction to this encroaching colonial power. And I think this is happening for the Bajorans, right? The fact that the Cardassians have occupied their world, this reinforces the Bajorans' national identity as with a unified goal of trying to push out the Cardassians, mm-hmm. right? And so, I think, you know, colonialism can be one of the factors that causes new nations to form. This happened here in the United States, right? We had the British Empire, essentially, that, we were revolting against in our American Revolution. And that's become part of our national identity. You know, it's impossible to tell the story of the United States of America without talking about the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. And we 240 years later, we still get the seeds of that identity in our own national consciousness now. And so, you know, I think that can be an important nationalistic factor, you know, any society that feels encroached on, you know, where the goal is to try to get the invaders out can cause a new national identity to emerge or be reinforced. But Mike, a minute ago, you were talking about how the fact that people come together in times of crisis. And I think that's true. I think you can see that, you know, throughout history. In our own American history, you can see things like Pearl Harbor that caused Americans to, you know, gel together and sort of create the culture of being willing to band together and go out and fight in World War II. Mm-hmm. After September 11th, you can see this reemergence of, in fact, in a global way, you could see, the world's nations came together after September 11th in a sort of this transnational way, you know, the sort of transnational coalitions that were formed, you know, leading into the Iraq War, mm-hmm. and whatnot. But the downside of that is that there can be this resurgence of patriotism in a negative sense, right? I'm really interested in this kind of dual nature of patriotism. On the one hand, patriotism can help reinforce our ideals. It can make you proud to be part of the society you're in. I think those are good elements. On the other hand, you can be overly patriotic to the point of disregarding the humanity of people who aren't part of your own culture or your own nation, your own group.
Death to the opposition.
Death to the opposition, as Worf would say, right? that's essentially right. We, you know, patriotism on steroids can lead to a death to the opposition kind of approach. Yes. And without fail, both of these things happen in times of crisis. You see people coming together almost without regard for culture, without regard for nations, to help one another. And there is this instinctive human need to help each other. And at the same time, there's this instinctive human need to band together and be different from other people. And so you can see this unhealthy patriotism that resurges at the very same time as this as people banding together to help each other in times of crisis. You saw that in World War II, and that led to things like McCarthyism, that led to things like the Japanese being interred, right? Mm-hmm. This is all happening in times of World War II. In September 11th, you get this resurgence of patriotism. You know, people, you know, flying flags behind their pickup trucks, you know, and doing whatever they do. And it just strikes me that there's these things come together. And I'm curious if there's a way to embrace the good side of that, people banding together to help each other and forming whatever organizations it takes to maintain the good there, getting the invaders out like the Bajorans. That's a good form of patriotism, I think, right? It's freedom fighters, right? There's a healthy connotation to freedom fighters that I think is an important part of our ongoing struggle for liberty in the world and in Star Trek, in the galaxy, in the universe. Mm-hmm. But that can devolve into unhealthy patriotism, a la racism, a la violence, a la, you know, interning people in internment camps, mm-hmm. you know, the various things that have happened in the name of patriotism. And how can you embrace the good and get rid of the bad in that kind of situation? But I think you're right that these things are heightened, both elements, the good and the bad, are heightened in times of crisis. And in Star Trek, you see this in Enterprise. I'm thinking of the attack on Earth in Enterprise, where that is one of the causes of the resurgence of this Earth First movement, right? This idea that this sort of reaction against the movement towards founding of the Federation, involving things like terrorist acts and whatnot that you see in the very final episodes of Enterprise. I like the way that Star Trek tries to deal with that situation in its most recent form, which is already, you know, however many years ago now, over 10 years ago. But Enterprise tries to deal with that very duality in its final season.
In the words of Paxton, Terra Prime forever. And Zachary, I think you're exactly right with the demons in Terra Prime. Those two episodes, we see as a result of the Zindi attack on Earth, this resurgence, this negative result of those events, and how it was able to spark in the hearts and minds of people who are who already possess a certain paranoia and a certain xenophobia, how it's able to fuel that. I think, unfortunately, those attitudes exist in people's hearts and in people's minds. And unfortunately, when these things happen, just as people respond in positive ways, you know, we, for instance, we build memorials and we support. I'm just overwhelmed at the support that my community has received from all around the country and indeed around the world after the tragic events of this past weekend with the shooting of these police officers here in downtown Dallas. The outpouring of love and support from the country and from around the world is truly humbling. But unfortunately, it also serves to further fuel, I think, in many regards, the already volatile nature of the relationship between law enforcement and the communities, blacks and whites. You know, John Frederick Paxton and his Terra Prime movement, I think, are really a great picture of how, you know, if it hadn't have been the Zindi attack, it would have been something. It would have been, you know, some Andorian taking up space in a restaurant. This kind of paranoia, this kind of xenophobia doesn't need racism. Call it whatever you want to call it. It doesn't really need a lot of fuel. But when you have an event like the Zindi attack, or in our universe, you have a 9/11 event, those things tend to bring out both the best and worst in people.
It could be as simple as Flocks trying to order a hamburger in a pub in San Francisco.
Or egg drop soup.
Well, Mike, we've been talking for over an hour here. Do you have any final thoughts on this topic of nationalism in Star Trek before we wrap it up?
Yeah, I think this has been a great conversation, and one that Zachary, you and I both knew that we wouldn't really be able to fully unwrap. You know, we didn't really get to talk much about, for instance, you know, we sort of touched on it, but it didn't come up, you know, Manifest Destiny, that concept of colonialism, if you will, and how it's represented in the Star Trek universe. You know, I think about, you know, the formation of the Maquis and, you know, their struggle to maintain their colonies and how they really became a nation in and of themselves. There was a certain national pride among those who were in the Maquis. And so there are many concepts here that we didn't really get to touch on. I hope that our listeners will chime in, because certainly in our own universe and in the Star Trek universe, there's a very fertile ground, you know, to explore this topic. And again, I think that there are some very positive aspects that I think that we can certainly capitalize on as we move forward and boldly go into this optimistic future that I know all of us as Star Trek fans are hopeful for. There are certainly elements of nationalism that I think are worth continuing and exploring, but there are also some negative aspects such as, you know, racism, tribalism, and these kind of colonialism that I think are negative aspects that we need to work together as human beings, as Star Trek fans, to find common ground and learn to embrace those differences and find ways in which we can still move forward towards common goals, and we can assist one another and help one another in difficult times, because at the end of the day, you know, whether you're a human, a Vulcan, an Andorian, a Tellarite, you are still a being, and as beings, we all have, I believe, a certain right and a certain dignity that needs to be respected, and that we can find common ground and we can work together towards common goals, because after all, as beings, we all have some things in common.
I think for my final thoughts, I'm really, like you, interested in the dual nature of these nationalistic factors. It's kind of the yin and the yang of it. On the one hand, the various factors that cause this nationalistic impulse can lead to a lot of good. You know, people banding together for mutual protection, that leads to a lot of good. People having a shared cultural history and carrying that identity forward, making that a part of themselves, I think that can cause a lot of good in society. reacting against totalitarianism that can cause an increase of freedom in the world, and that's a good thing. So there's lots of positive factors to nationalism that I wouldn't want to get rid of. But then there are all these bad factors, the things you meant, the bad consequences, things like racism, things like Nazism, things like terrorism. Those are things that are rightly thought to, that we think we should weed out. we don't want to carry those into the 24th century with us if we can avoid it. Zindi attack aside, I guess. So I guess my question is fundamentally, how can we keep the good and get rid of the bathwater? How can we maintain, like we see in the 24th century, the Federation does this. There's a Federation identity, and that it tries to, maintain that identity and hold on to the Federation values while not having, a society that is exclusive of other people or that is judgmental of other people or causes violence against other people. And how can you, hold the good parts of those national ideals and ditch the bad? I guess that's my fundamental question. But in the 24th century, I think as Star Trek fans, we kind of have this myth we tell ourselves about the world we see in Star Trek, that in the Star Trek universe is transnationalist, right? That we've moved beyond the need to have things like nations and things like political organizations. But we see all the signs of nationalism in the 24th century. We see the symbols like flags and icons and a certain style of dress and whatnot, and those serve to distinguish Federation culture from other cultures that you see, the Klingons or Romulans or whatnot. You see, shared values. You see a political organization based on certain ideals that are codified in the Constitution. And essentially, my claim is that the Federation is a nationalistic entity, that tries to hold on to the good. It tries to go out and explore and form diplomatic relationships with other nation states, writ large, intergalactic nation states, right? World-sized nation states at the level of the different worlds that we see in the Star Trek universe. But I think it's a mistake to say that the Federation has transcended the need for nationalism, because it has all the symbols and signs of nationalism. So I think when people look at the Federation and say, oh, look, we've transcended all these weak human impulses merely because Earth has transcended those things, right? Yeah, okay, the United States and France and pick your favorite country on Earth may have disbanded for the sake of forming a world government that has become part of the Federation, that has morphed into the Federation. That doesn't mean that we've transcended nationalism, because the Federation writ large has almost every sign and symbol of nationalism that you could think of. And we see all of those things inside the Star Trek universe. So I guess my fundamental question is, given that nationalism has not gone away inside the 24th century that we see, is that something that should be transcended? Should the goal of the Federation be to continue to, I don't want to say subsume, because that sounds too negative, but continue to grow by collaborating and partnering and increasing its territory through good, healthy partnerships with whatever new worlds it encounters, and continuing to go out into the galaxy? Should that be the ideal of the Federation, to continue to grow and become larger than it is? And Captain Picard says something very much like this inside Star Trek Nemesis, that we can transcend all of these differences, and we can come together as one. And is that the ideal of the Federation, to continue to grow and expand and continue to flourish, and in other words, seeing the decline of other nations that are out there for the sake of forming one sort of intergalactic, progressively larger, more universalistic, transnationalistic society? What is the 25th and the 26th and the 27th century version of the Federation going to look like on that trajectory? Or is the Federation content to be one amongst many, one voice in an intergalactic chorus, right? Where the Federation is its galactic sized nation state, and the Klingon Empire is its galactic sized nation state. Same thing with the Cardassian Empire and whatnot. Is the Federation content with the pluralism and the diversity of those different nation states? Or is that something akin to the infancy that we're in here in the world today, that's something to be transcended and moved beyond? Is that a sign of weakness on the part of the Federation, that they haven't moved beyond that nationalistic need in the 24th century? Or will they continue that nationalistic trajectory century and these other empires will just become subsumed in this increasingly cosmopolitan, increasingly intergalactic, one galaxy kind of society, akin to the forming of the Federation in relation to the state we're in on Earth today.
Well, Zachary, you stirred a thought, and I know we just gave final thoughts, but when you were talking about Picard's speech, you know, we can transcend these differences. I think in order to do that, in order to transcend those differences, you know, there has to be a state of compromise. Somebody has got to give up whatever the difference is and accept a new way of thinking or a new way of doing something. So you're giving up your own national identity and assuming a new one. So again, to my original point when we began the discussion, I don't believe that this is something that can be transcended because I do believe that it is something that is very core to who we are. I mean, Catherine Janeway goes to the Delta Quadrant. She's going to hold on to her Federation principles. And in fact, in many ways, she's going to perpetuate those principles throughout the Delta Quadrant. She's going to build coalitions. And even as we go along in season 6 and 7, she has this tendency to build these little federations out there in the Delta Quadrant in order to achieve an objective. So I don't know if it's something that we're capable of transcending. Is the Federation content to live alongside these other nation states? I think certainly, but I just don't see an end to this idea of national identity, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. But the myth that in the Star Trek universe we have transcended the need for nationalism, I think we've debunked that myth completely and given adequate reasons why nationalism is still alive and well, at least for Captain Solok.
See, Mike, this is why I would like to see an extra season of Deep Space Nine. I know a lot of people would like to see an extra season of Deep Space Nine. For a lot of people, it's their favorite Star Trek series. But for me, I would like to see some of the fallout of the War of the Dominion. You know, in fighting the War with the Dominion, different races banded together for the sake of fighting this war against the Dominion, essentially forming an even larger political unit than the Federation, right? You have people coming together for a common purpose, setting aside their differences for the sake of fighting a common enemy. And without fail, when there's pressure from the outside, that happens. People band together for the sake of fighting an enemy, right? We see that here in the United States in our American Revolution. We see that in the forming of the Federation. We see that in the fighting the war against the Dominion. So, things like the Dominion encroaching on the Federation, or things like Species 8472 potentially invading from fluidic space, right? These are factors that can cause different new larger types of political organizations to emerge. People setting aside their differences, forming a new kind of unit, maybe forming a new identity insofar as they're fighting a common purpose. So will the future history of the galaxy be a future history of increasingly larger political organizations to the extent that they become galactic or universal in scope? Or will those organizations continue to be a plurality? Will they reach kind of a max size at the level of the Federation or various empires that you see in the Star Trek universe, where no more future growth is possible from the standpoint of the size of the political unit? So it's a really interesting question to see what the future history of the Federation would be. Maybe we'll get a peek at this in the next Star Trek series coming in 2017. You never know. There's lots of, as Gene Roddenberry would say, there's lots of potential for new stories out there.
This far and no further.
Yeah, that's right. Will the Federation go this far and no further, right? Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about nationalism and flying the flag of the Federation here on Metatrex today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
The DNA of Star Trek fandom, and I've said it before, fandom existed, fandom enjoyed the show, but the main charge of fandom was to get the damn thing back.
Warp 5.
The Romulans had their ship in season 4 that had the holograms that made it look like any other ship. So you could theoretically retcon Minefield into saying they were using that same technology back then.
Literary Treks.
We have a long tradition here on Literary Treks of taking things seriously.
and having a good time while doing that. Tonight, well, we were going to take it seriously, but then the comics wouldn't let us.
The 602 Club.
Yeah, I had a similar experience where, you know, I was talking to a guy, the new movie's coming out, obviously, and I'm like, have you seen the first one? And he's like, no, I haven't. And I'm like, okay, well, let me bring it to you so you can take a look. And he watched it, and he came back the next day, and he's like, oh, yeah, that movie was really good.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Pretty much wherever you get your podcasts, you can find Trek FM podcasts. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network through Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbital will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also contact us via voicemail, look in the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, we're under the handle @trekfm.
You can also find us on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/trekfm. And while you're there, be sure to check out our listeners-only discussion group, The Babel Conference. Type The Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. Again, that's our listeners-only discussion group. It's a closed group, but if you click join, someone will let you right in.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show, and it's one of the most important and simplest things you can do to help us out, to help other listeners find the show. We'd love to hear your thoughts on anything we've talked about. Oh, Mike, when you're not flying the Federation flag behind your shuttlecraft, blasting Oogie Boogie, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network these days?
Well, Zachary, you can find me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. And in the Babel Conference on Twitter, my handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you're not planning the Federation Founders Day celebration, where can people find you?
Well, other than being here on MetaTreks, you can find me as a semi-frequent guest on The Ready Room, Trek FM's flagship show. You can find me on Facebook in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, @ZacharyFruehling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, and Fruehling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network, specifically C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Will Wynn, our content manager, and Richard Marquez, our production manager. And we'd also like to give a special thank you and a shout out to our two associate producers for MetaTreks, Patrick Devlin and Kay Elizabeth Janeway. You can find Patrick on Twitter under the handle @MagicDrop5, and you can find Kay Elizabeth Janeway under the handle @ChocoWeeble. We really want to thank both of our associate producers for their support of Trek.fm in general and MetaTreks in particular. Thank you very much for your support. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.